You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Tomorrow marks a very special occasion for my next guests and for the whole of the country, in fact. One of our most cherished and lauded writers, who has already a six-decade career of astonishing work behind her, will celebrate her 90th birthday. Last year, on receiving the David Cohen Prize for Literature, she was praised for having, quote, moved mountains, both politically and lyrically, and that was through her writing. It's a great honour and joy to have Edna O'Brien with us this evening. Happy birthday ahead of tomorrow, Edna. What are the plans in terms of celebration? Are there many?
Answering the door. Well, there aren't many, really, because, you know, with this virus that everyone is nervous of, social life is very limited. And I just feel being 90 at all is a bit of a miracle. It's also, I don't probably have as much energy as I had at 80. But I have no big plans, no. I couldn't, really. Not this year. I'm not really helping you because I'm truly not doing anything. Because it's not the year to do something.
Does that mean that you are or are not writing, then, in this year?
Well, I mean, who'd be writing if I'm getting all these messages and phone calls and interviews? I've written the T.S. Eliot lecture. I finished it last week, and it goes out tomorrow evening. That took 11 months, so that was writing.
And did that take a different type of energy or a different type of toll on you?
Yes, very different. Very different part of the mind, body, imagination, investigation, nervousness. Very, very different indeed, because it involves huge, perhaps too much, because I'm rather, what's the word, I'm still a convent girl in that way, a lot of research, and therefore making notes and losing them. Not that writing is a free activity, but writing something that comes just from the imagination is more freeing than writing something about someone else, when you have to be very certain of all your facts and try and make it then seem like a work of imagination. Make it seem creative or spontaneous or whatever the words are. So that is a harder task. They're all hard, actually. Mm-hmm. If I'd finished a novel yesterday, I'd be probably saying the same thing.
When that award that you won last year, the David Cohen Prize, the citation said, as I mentioned in my introduction, that you moved mountains both politically and lyrically. What type of mountains do you think you've been moving over the years? Did you feel that it was an apt description of what you've been doing with your writing?
Well, I felt it was very complimentary. I think it would be for others to say whether it was apt or not. I was very pleased to get it. But I was also very pleased about the fact that my books are political. They don't seem so. But what I do, or aim to do, is to take a political situation and make it the backdrop to a human story. So a direct political book, like, say, Fritz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, that's purely political book, and it's a very good book and a very disturbing book. I'm still very interested, for some reason, in human beings, in what people do to each other or don't do, in how people behave in difficult situations, in crisis, and so on. And with both girls, which was about the Boko Haram capturing and of young schoolgirls and submitting them to every known kind of humiliation and trauma. And so taking the human story and giving it its political dimension. But the political part is there. It is like the mountain. And the human story is sort of all along. I saw today that Etna erupted. I thought, yeah, that's what writing is. It's an eruption of a kind which has to be, if it's going to be any good or last any length of time, has to have some beauty, the way music has beauty, has to have some not some, but a lot of that, and of truth, and of human palpability, that the reader will feel, I want this as a writer, and I want it as a reader, that the reader will feel when reading the story, this is a story of real people.
So is the initial impetus then, for example, in the case of Girl, and it's a fictional story of a young character called Miriam, a Nigerian girl who's captured by Boko Haram. Is the initial impetus the political situation that you were reading about in the newspapers, seeing in the news, and that you then say, I have to find a fictional way to tell this story or to make comment on this? Or was the initial impetus some fictional idea, this character who was somehow spurring you on?
Well, to tell you the truth with that, Sean, it's very hard to know which comes the car before the horse or the horse before the cart. They're intertwined. There's a lot of political stories in the world, God help us. They're everywhere. Camps, refugees, migration, wars, they're everywhere. The Middle East is like a bloodbath. I picked that particular one because I felt or hoped that I could identify with the inner life of a girl in that awful situation. I could identify with her fear, not to the same extent as she felt it, but it wasn't alien terror. It was alien to me, and yet I felt I knew some of it. As I said, there are other stories I could have taken on board, but with Girl and with The Little Red Chairs, I took on political stories, and I felt that even before I started, you have to know before you start, that I'd make it, that I could do it, with effort, with time, with faith, hope, and all those other qualities. Whereas some stories, I could not even attempt to begin. And I did read a lot. I read a lot of journalists, including Sally Hayden from Ireland. She reports for the Irish Times. And I met with her, and she was wonderful, and she helped me a little. By that, she was mostly away, but when I say a little, she gave me some time. But, you know, she was herself very busy traveling. I haven't seen her for over a year. So the research was enormous. I went twice to Nigeria. I went to camps. I went to schools. I went to organizations. I went to parents. I went to, you name it. And some of it was very, very heartbreaking, and is very heartbreaking. Even yesterday, or maybe it was the night before, there was another case in Nigeria from another school. 400 people were taken.
Yes.
And it didn't say who was responsible. Well, it probably will by this evening. So there's no division. There's division, but it's fine to ask the question, but I cannot answer it in a sort of, if you like, a logical way. I had a hunch I could do this, and my hunch was borne out by my going there.
There was some criticism, obviously, people have heard about the New Yorker magazine, and particularly this idea that somehow it was the horror of that story that attracted you rather than something
yes,
else.
And I was very annoyed by that. I was deeply annoyed by that. If I wanted to write a horror story, I'd write a horror story. I wanted to write a human story. It was a very wrong, not only wrong, it was an unwise way to think of the book, and it was rash. You know, I mean, there are horror stories, plenty of them in the world. They don't suit me either as a reader or a writer. Girl is a human story. I read Greek myths. I read the stories of Hecuba, Electra, all those men and women in crisis, and the things that happen to people in crisis, and how they bear it. How do they bear it? That is the question.
Was the reaction to Girl in some way similar to the reaction to In the Forest back in 2002, when similarly there were this idea that perhaps you were taking a very personal story, the murder of Imelda Rowney and her young son, that you were taking that very closely intimate story and making fiction out of it? Was it a similar type of reaction to the reaction to Girl, do you think?
There's a resemblance, definitely. It's usually to do those who begrudge or cavil or say I shouldn't do it or you shouldn't do it or it shouldn't be done. They usually have an agenda which is not stated. The world is full of stories. The world needs stories. I have written stories about domestic life, domestic situations, love, mothers, everything, funerals even, old wounds, who'll pay for the tombstone, etc. But not to say that somebody has no right, that one is no territorial right on another, on a country that isn't one's own or a story that isn't one's own, is a form of censorship in itself that I do not go with. There should be no borders to the imagination. The only border that I would call for would be that the book is written, if you like, from within. It has the inner pulse. It has that the writer has come to know, both through research, through intuition, and God knows what else, through luck, what the internals of that story should be. And the people who object are usually doing so for quite personal and, I regret to say, sometimes ignoble reasons.
What about the type of energy, the type of mountain that you have to move? You're speaking about, I suppose, the political side of the story in many of those comments, but the energy that you have to use, the mountain that you have to move within yourself to get to that inner life, to get to the internals of a book.
Oh, it's a nightmare. That's what I'd like to say to some of my... But mind you, with Girl, I was very lucky with Girl in many places. I have the paperback here with radiant quotes on it. In the Forest was more personal, was made more personal. The objection to Girl in the United States, apart from that one profile you mentioned, which is best forgotten, but the so-called good reviews said they were waiting. One critic said she was waiting for the real book about Boko Haram, a girl. There's no one real book. We know the facts of the story. Each girl will be affected by her incarceration differently, will dream differently when she's there, and if she's lucky enough to get out, will dream differently, will remember certain moments that another girl will have forgotten, and vice versa. So there's many stories. It's not like a single piece of journalism.
In the case of The Country Girls, it was 3 weeks. You sat down at the desk, and I think it was a matter of weeks later you had it all written. And
it came. Oh, that was such a lovely feeling. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. 3 weeks it gets me to write the first paragraph. 3 more weeks to write the second one. That is inevitable. I think a first book is like a winged messenger. It comes to one, which is sometimes, not always, but sometimes a little disquieting for an author, because she or he then begins to do the next book and finds that it's not as easy. First book is waiting. The second book, third book, 10th book, 15th book, they have to be dredged out. It doesn't mean they're better or worse. It just means that it's like drawing water from a well. How much more is left in the well?
Well, Girl was your 19th novel. Is there a 20th novel down at the bottom of that well, even if you have to get the bucket down very deep to find it?
Oh, I'm afraid so. There's no other way. There's no other way. And it's not simply by will alone, although it needs very strong will to do it. It's by that mysterious thing called inspiration, which does come, oddly enough. And also in the doing, when you start a book and you're floundering a bit or you're unsteady about your material, by keeping with it and by reading certain significant things, not quite the same story, but have something of the same quality, you find yourself becoming richer. For instance, there's a great book I have always loved by Joseph Conrad called The Heart of Darkness. I read and reread The Heart of Darkness many times when I was writing Girl. Mine is a totally different story. Joseph Conrad's was Congo, in fact, and it was on a boat. It was by the main character was male, but there was something very hard again to verbalize or to explain clearly about the landscape itself, the enormity of it, the loneliness of it, then the sort of mystery within it. There's a darkness in it, and you come on people where you never think you would come upon them. And in many ways, it gave me not facts, but it gave me a sense of a landscape. Because landscape, as when I wrote all my early books and short stories, the Irish landscape, County Clare, was of great, well, it enriched the stories, and it was of great, I thought about it a lot, and it was like a character itself. It moved me. It still moves me.
Coming
it's
then.
It's so hard to kind of say precisely what it is that makes one a writer. That's often what families, people within the same families, often wonder why that person could write a book and he or she in that same family couldn't. I mean, it is a gift, for want of a word. Well, no, that's the word. It is a gift that then has to be worked at studiously and constantly. And that comes from rereading, well, reading, but in the case of great books, rereading and rereading and learning.
Coming then to the T.S. Eliot lecture, which will be broadcast in the Abbey Theatre tomorrow night, what was his gift? And what did you discover in putting that lecture together was his gift?
Well, I'll tell you, the person who would solve that, T.S. Eliot, wouldn't be able to tell you himself either. He had a gift. It's like, you know, a child born with, you know, in the time when we believed in the fairies. The way in poetry, not in critical essays and not in his plays, but in his poetry, the way he just moves, he glides from one scene. Every line is a scene in itself. And the way it moves just arbitrarily to something totally different. And the music, talking of music, that he brings to each line, the shifting of thought, the shifting of emotion, and something that you, as a reader, this sounds paradox to say, that something one both understands and does not understand. In the fact that you can read it each time, you know, I read The Wasteland and the Four Quartets and some of those poems again and again, and each time I found something extraordinary in them, and something I hadn't seen the first time. And what is so seductive about T.S. Eliot, and I mean the word seductive, is the way he does it, the language he chooses, is so fresh and yet so ancient. When you're reading it, you feel, oh, this is happening now as I'm reading it. And yet it's infused, if that's the word, with the timelessness as well. I mean, his gift was very great. And also, I would say to say, very mysterious to him himself as well. Because his prose, quite frankly, does not sing. It's thoughtful, it's critical, but it doesn't have, just doesn't have that moment or that ongoing, ceaseless moments of what, for want of the word, I can't think straight today, of magic within it. It doesn't, whereas his poetry does. And it has to be remembered, it took 7 years to write a poem. The long ones. The Wasteland took 7 years. Four Quartet took 6 or 7 years. He wrote all the time, but then from what he wrote, he had to pluck the line that he knew by instinct was the line that mattered, the line that lived.
Finally, Edna, 2020, it's safe to say, has been a most peculiar year. Now, I'm guessing it's been the most peculiar year you've experienced to date. What impact do you think it might have, if any, on literature, and when might we see that?
It'll have a considerable impact on literature, which one doesn't know yet, because these things don't show themselves for a while. They don't realise themselves within a human being or imagination. I think it probably will have made some people more thoughtful and hopefully more generous with their wealth. I think for some people will go under because the hopelessness within it, if they have very little to eat, children, no money, very cramped place to live, that will be a blight forever. And then there will be a few who will write about it in the same way as Albert Camus wrote about the plague, or people wrote about the Black Death, or John Donne made sermons about the Black Death. There will be some literature from it. There'll be a lot of casualties. And let us hope there will be some degree of wisdom, and by that, less arrogant and arrant selfishness.
Edna, an absolute privilege and pleasure to speak with you this evening. Have a great day tomorrow, whatever you get up to. Enjoy the birthday. Happy 90th from all of us here, I'm sure, in on Arena, in RTE, and throughout the country. Many people will want to pass on their best wishes to you.
Can I say the same in return? Thank you all very, very much. I feel delighted that you asked me to talk to you, and I feel delighted that someone will say, she's 90, she's hanging on. So I say thank you, a big thank you.
Edna O'Brien and the T.S. Eliot Lecture, given by Edna O'Brien, will be available on the Abbey Theatre YouTube channel from tomorrow, and that will be her 90th birthday.
And slán shugolaya.
And some lovely responses coming in to that interview with Edna O'Brien. Colette Brown: Edna O'Brien, who turns 90 tomorrow, is sounding as effortlessly erudite and decisive as ever. Couldn't agree more. Sian Quill: I could listen to Edna O'Brien all evening. Happy 90th birthday to her. And Mary Call: listening to Edna O'Brien on RTE Arena is just a pure pleasure. She is without doubt one of the truly great writers this country has produced. At 90, she's still smarter than most of us were on our best day. Yes, amazing to speak with her, and what great points she had to make. Sad news indeed yesterday evening with the announcement of the death of John le Carré, beloved best-selling author of thrillers like The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and A Perfect Spy. He was 89. His friend John Banville joins me now on the line. John, le Carré is often, I suppose, the greatest praise that's given to him is that he elevated the spy novel into the realm of high art. Would you agree with that statement? And if so, how did he go about doing that?
Yes, I would agree with it. I think quite a number of his books are definitely works of art. He did it by concentration and by extremes of imagination, which is the way any work of art is made. He was a wonderful writer. I mean, he was wonderfully entertaining. You know, I wouldn't want anybody to be put off by the notion of him writing works of art. But I think definitely The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, that one alone is a masterpiece of 20th century fiction. I hate the notion of genre anyway, but he certainly transcended the genre in that.
Did he change, I suppose, how the spy was portrayed from what had been there previous to that? In many ways, when people think of the spy, I suppose they probably think of the Secret Service agent, they think of Bond and the Ian Fleming books. This was a very different type of spy that Le Carré gave us.
Yes, I can imagine the spy came in from the cold, falling lifeless from the hands of Ian Fleming, who must have been horrified by, you know, somebody actually writing about the real thing. Fleming had his place, James Bond has his place, but this was a real thing. This was an extraordinary work. And, I mean, look, the beautiful thing about it is that it works like a Swiss watch. I read it again recently for, I don't know how many times I've read it, but I read it again recently, and I could not find a fault in it. I mean, it's as near to perfection as you can get.
One of the things that in terms of Le Carré is this whole idea, he could manage to entertain and to give us something that had real substance within it. To what extent do you think his time with MI5 or working as a spy himself really informed that, or is that overstated?
Well, look, it's very hard to know because, you know, David was, David Cornwell is his real name. David was very playful and, you know, was I taken in by his assertions that his spying days consisted of nothing more than pen pushing and the odd meeting on a street corner? I don't know how deeply embedded he was as a spy. His life story, which we can't go into here, but his con man father and his absconding mother, I mean, you know, these were things that would be the makings of a spy. He loved the intricacies of life. He loved the background to things. When I met him first, you know, he knew more about me than I think I knew about myself. He'd gone into it, you know. And he loved doing that. But he was able to do it without any sense of being sneaky. You know, he just loved the world. He loved life. He loved entertaining. He loved the fact that his book sold millions of copies. Gave away a lot of his money, set up foundations, lived a good life, lived a wonderful life. I mean, I say I'm his friend, and I feel a bit of a fraud because I only met him last year, but he was one of those people, and I know this will sound like an awful cliche, it's the kind of thing people say about people when they've died, but he was instantly warm, instantly we became friends. I mean, I met him, we shook hands, and he had the most extraordinary handshake. The handshake seemed to enfold me entirely. Now, you could say, oh, that was part of the trickery of being a spy. I don't think it was. I think he was absolutely straightforward. He didn't believe in communism. He didn't agree with communism. He hated it. He thought it would destroy the West. He spied on his fellow students when he was young and made no apologies for it. He said they were dealing with totalitarianism, and I felt that totalitarianism was in danger of destroying the world. I think he was an honourable man, oddly enough.
Given what you're saying about him there seems to be a very strong political streak and within him, an ethical streak within him as well. I guess and a patriotism within him in terms of what he believed about totalitarianism. But in more recent times, in fact, you interviewed him on the release of the most recent novel, Agent Running in the Field. He was very strongly political and very vocal about what he thought was happening to his beloved England.
Oh, yes. He is very much an old-fashioned English patriot. Not a streak of nationalism in him, whatever, but real patriot. Loved his country, loved democracy, loved the way of life that we have here. For all its faults, it still seemed the best to him. And he was ready to fight for it. And I suppose, in a way, you know, I wouldn't want to go too far, but I think his books were part of his way of fighting for decency. Mm. It's the one I always think of when I think of him, is decency.
I have a clip here of him in an interview from 2017. This was with Charlie Rose on the 60 Minutes programme in the United States. And we get a sense of how he felt about the establishment in this clip.
You've turned down literary honours. You've turned down a knighthood?
Yes.
Why?
In my own country, I'm so suspicious of the literary world that I don't want its accolades. And least of all do I want to be called a commander of the British Empire or any other thing of the British Empire. I find it emetic.
And why do you feel that way?
I don't want to posture as somebody who's been honoured by the state and must therefore somehow conform with the state. And I don't want to wear the armour.
Your writing partner, George Smiley,
yep,
had this to say on the subject. The privately educated Englishman is the greatest dissembler on earth. No one will charm you so glibly, disguise his feelings from you better, cover his tracks more skillfully, or find it harder to confess that he's been a damn fool. No one acts braver when he's frightened stiff, or happier when he's miserable. And nobody can flatter you better when he hates you than an extrovert Englishman or woman.
Yeah, I think that's very good. I like that. Yes, I do.
Do you consider yourself an Englishman?
What kind of Englishman at the moment? Yes, of course, I'm born and bred English. I'm English to the core. My England would be the one that recognises its place in the European Union, the jingoistic England that is trying to march us out of the EU. That is an England I don't want to know.
John Le Carré there in a 2017 interview with Charlie Rose on the 60 Minutes programme in the United States. John Banville is speaking with us this evening about Le Carré. You really get a sense just in that last section of that clip how angry he was, John, about the potential of what could happen.
He was absolutely furious, and like many of us, most of us I would hope, he feared for what was happening, not just in England, but in America, in Russia, in Hungary, and all over the world, because the resurgence of fascism. And he's very clear about that. He was so disgusted with his England having betrayed itself by the Brexit vote, he was contemplating moving to Ireland. He came here, the beginning of this year, and went down to Cork to look into his family roots there. I think it was in Roscarbery. He talked to somebody who was some kindly woman who was in charge of the local records, and she said to him, "Welcome home, welcome home." He was getting his Irish passport, and he really was seriously thinking of coming here. He really was disgusted with what was happening in England. And look, surely all right-thinking people would agree with him. It's terrible what's happening to that poor country. England was always, so tolerant, so welcoming of odd people. It let Karl Marx live there. All kinds of strange people were allowed to live there. And now it has turned its face against Europe. It's a disaster. And he knew that and banged on about it. And I love the way he did bang on about it.
He also, in the midst of that clip, mentions George Smiley, the character from Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. How magnificent a creature and a creation is Smiley in your mind, John Banville?
I think he's a wonderful literary figure. I didn't like Alec Guinness's portrayal. I thought it was mannered and downright silly in a way. And the trouble is that now in most people's minds, when they hear the name George Smiley, they think of Alec Guinness. But he is a marvellous creation. He's a marvellous creation. He will live as long as Sherlock Holmes.
And in those terms, then, what about Le Carré's impact on cinema and television and how The Spy was presented in cinema and on television? Do we really need to go to the books, or did any of the cinema or television portrayals meet the standard of the books in your mind?
Well, now, there's a question. Of course, I would say, read the books.
I thought you might.
Inevitably. But I think even though, I'm a writer myself, but read the books, because that's where the real stuff is. He loved the television things. He always made a little appearance in them himself, like Hitchcock. And he loved it. He loved seeing them fleshed out, literally fleshed out, seeing his characters fleshed out. But the books are still the place to go to for the real Le Carré.
There was a much made of the quote from Timothy Garton Ash writing in The New Yorker in 1999 that the books are not about spying at all, that betrayal is the real theme of Le Carré's work. Do you see that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The poor man was betrayed as a child by his parents, horribly betrayed, survived it, made himself into as he said, people who've had unhappy childhoods are very good at reinventing themselves. But then we all reinvent ourselves. We have to when we leave childhood and realize that mommy is not coming back, we have to make ourselves, make a face to deal with the world. He did very well indeed. He was a delightful man. I mean, such good company. Goodness. I miss him. Really miss him sorely.
And you had no sense. I was reading the article, the interview that you had with him was published in The Guardian in October. Was there any sense at that point, was it October of this year or last year, was there any sense at that point, October 19, 2019, had you any sense that he was in any way, you know, finishing up?
Oh, no. I mean, he was suffering from bone cancer. He was, I said, well, how is that? He said, well, it's a bit sore now and then, but I'm coping. He was coping. He was definitely thinking about a new book. He was extraordinarily vigorous. I mean, he was more vigorous than I was. I'm, I don't know how many years younger than him. I mean, he looked like a 60-year-old. Mm. Spoke like a 60-year-old. Absolutely no sense of any diminution in intellectual powers. As I say, I mean, I, one of the things about him, which anybody knew him, you know, is he was such a wonderful mimic. He's one of those people who just, you know, I had for a moment or two, the person he's mimicking is there with, at the table with you. He could do it so well. And he told his stories with such droll humor and such wit and self-deprecating. You know, he did not behave in any way like a great man. You know, he didn't flaunt his reputation or his money. He was a good man. He was a good man.
Well, that's as good a legacy as anybody can have, isn't it? He was a good man. Thanks very much for speaking to us this evening, John.
Thanks.
John Banville speaking to us there about his pal, John Le Carré. A good man is what he says. But now we're going to talk about something, well, maybe not that different. Wonder Woman, another Wonder Woman, also known as Princess Diana of Themyscira, a character that has appeared in various comics, TV shows and films from nearly 80 years, I beg your pardon. Famously played by Linda Carter in the 70s, Wonder Woman finally got her own blockbuster film in 2017. Now, on the eve of the release of the sequel to that 2017 movie, the new movie is called Wonder Woman 1984, and Carl Austin is here with me to take a look at one of pop culture's most enduring feminist icons. Where did she start, actually, Wonder Woman, Carl?
You mean created?
As a character,
as
yeah.
As a character. Well, she was created in 1941, I believe, by a writer / psychologist named William Moulton... I forgot what his last name is.
Marston.
Thank you, Marston. Jeez, I forgot what his last name was for a moment there. Blanked it. Wonder Woman was basically created as an antidote to what he considered to be a problem that was in comic books at the time, which was the male character who always solved every problem with violence. He was a very, you know, hardcore feminist, and he believed that he could come up with a superhero that had the powers of, say, a Superman or, you know, any of those mighty heroes, but also had what he believed were the feminine qualities that made women stronger than men, which is that you solve problems with love first, rather than going straight to beating someone to a pulp and sending them to jail.
So William Moulton Marston in 1941, the psychologist bit might be part of the reason for this, but he clearly was... I'm presuming, was he practically a lone male voice in saying this type of thing?
Absolutely. In fact, one of his major issues with the way Wonder Woman was treated in the comics that he didn't write was that she was relegated, like, as a, for instance, when she was made part of the Justice Society of America, she was relegated to being the team secretary, which just made him amazingly angry, as it probably did Wonder Woman, to be honest. There weren't a lot of voices, male or otherwise, in comics at the time who would have thought to come up with a character quite like this. Mm. And it's one of the things that makes her really unique. And I think it's one of the reasons why she's lasted in appeal for 79 years, to be exact.
Isn't there something actually wonderfully ironic then in the fact that it was her appearance in it, to bring it up to date, when in the Gal Gadot? I'll come back to the 90s. I'm not going to skip. I'm not going to skip.
Can't skip the 70s.
No, we can't skip the 70s. That's fine. But there is something wonderful in the fact that it was Gal Gadot in Batman versus Superman, Dawn on Justice, that was actually what led to, there she was as a sidekick, but that was, she played them off the screen and she got her own movie as a result.
Played them off the screen is putting it kindly. She just shone like a light in that film. It was, to my knowledge, there was a Wonder Woman movie on the table. They were hoping that the character would be, you know, something that the audience would take to and they could go on to that. But the fact that she came in there and stormed it. Yeah. Absolutely stormed it.
Right, we'll come back to that bit of the story later on, but we do have to start here.
Wonder Woman! Wonder Woman! All the world is waiting for you and the power you possess. In your satin tights, fighting for your rights, and the old red, white, and blue.
I want to be sitting in front of dodgy telly.
I have to be honest with you. In my head, I am. Right this second, I'm in front of a really dodgy telly in my living room. I'm like 8 years old with my jaw on the floor.
This is Linda Carter as Wonder Woman.
Some of it for reasons that I had no idea why at the time. I'm eight, and it just made me feel funny. I don't know why, but Linda Carter, man, Linda Carter as Wonder Woman, just. I love Gal Gadot, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But for me, when I go to Wonder Woman, I go back to that childhood image of Linda Carter in the red, white, and blue, you know, with the gold bracelets and that song playing. And
the truth lasso. Did she have
the lasso of truth?
Lasso of truth,
and the invisible jet.
Yeah. Important to have all the powers, isn't it? There had been a movie made for TV before the television series, but it kind of disappeared without trace, didn't it?
Yeah, it's like I tried to find it this week and had no luck, actually. In 1974, there was a made-for-TV movie that was meant to serve as a pilot for a Wonder Woman TV series. It starred Kathy Lee Crosby, but they made a very odd decision. They chose to draw from the stories, the Wonder Woman stories, that during a period in the 1960s, I believe, where she had no superpowers. They changed the character to be, she was more like a James Bond type super spy. She still had a red, white, and blue outfit, but it was more of a jumpsuit, really. And she drove around in a car. She had gadgets. She fought with kung fu moves. It was a very odd choice.
And then when they did come to the television series, first of all, in the first season, there were three seasons, I think. First season, we weren't in the 1970s.
No, we were in the 1940s. They went back to the original story of Wonder Woman, which is that she came to man's world during World War II and kicked Nazi butt.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, it's like there's really nothing better than Linda Carter kicking Nazi butt.
Well, just before, something that I should have asked you about, Marston, his polyamorous relationships. these were maybe explain the nature of the man's tastes and how it fed into his creation of Wonder Woman.
He was indeed in a polyamorous relationship. He was married to his wife Elizabeth, and they had a life partner who I believe his name was Olive. Now, according to legend, the character of Wonder Woman her physical appearance is an amalgamation of the two women that he chose to live his life with.
Well, he couldn't really have her looking like one or other of them, could he? That wouldn't work.
That probably would result in a lot of sleeping on the sofa, so I hope not. And apparently, it's also said that his initial idea for the character came from his wife, Elizabeth, because he pitched her the idea of a superhero who fought with love rather than violence. And she looked him in the eye and said, well, then I guess you better make her a woman.
Right.
And plus Wonder Woman was born.
A little bit of polyamour might just feed into your literary life if you're thinking of looking for some inspiration. Good luck with that one. Let's have a listen to Linda Carter in action, because it's vital that we know about Steve Trevor. He's in a very important part of her story.
Very important part of the mythology.
Explain who he is.
Oh, okay, Steve Trevor. In the original story, Steve Trevor is a American World War II pilot who crash lands on the island of Themyscira. Now, he needs to be returned to America. He can't stay on the island. Only women are allowed on the island. He needs to be returned, and he has vital information to help fight against the Nazis.
Right, and so, here is Linda Carter rescuing him from the Nazis in this clip from the 70s television series.
I'll have you free in a few seconds. Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine. Pride's hurt a little bit. Once again, I'm in your debt, Wonder Woman. I should have never fallen into this trap.
I believe we were both tricked into being here.
Yes, but by whom?
Well, we'll find out. The important thing now is to get to safety.
There you go. Linda Carter and Lyle Waggoner as Wonder Woman and Steve Trevor from the 1970s TV series. Carl Austin with us in studio this evening ahead of tomorrow's release of Wonder Woman 1984, which means we have to talk about Gal Gadot and what she did for the character in 2017 with the first of her own films, Wonder Woman's own film. What did she bring to the character? What kind of character did we get in this cinematic representation?
I think for the first time, a truly strong, independent Wonder Woman who was her own person and wasn't necessarily defined by the relationship with Steve Trevor. There is a romance between the two of them, but it isn't the thing that defines her. And that is one of the things about the 1970 shows that I do remember it was like Wonder Woman's life seemed to kind of, you know, be kind of all about Steve Trevor a lot of the time.
There was a touch of the will they, won't they thing. Will it work out? Won't it work out all the time, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was. It was very moonlighting. and it didn't feel like the Wonder Woman I knew in the comics.
And in terms of the action sequences that we got in that previous film, the 2017 Wonder Woman film, what was their nature? How impressive were they?
To be honest with you, they were stunning. I still see that image in my head of her on that battlefield, standing up and walking out to save that village when everyone else around her is running and saying, you know, we have to get out of here. There's no point. And she stands up and she just walks out there. It's just that image of Gal Gadot walking across that battlefield straight into it. And it gave me goosebumps when I saw
it. What is Gadot, and I suppose, what is Wonder Woman as portrayed in that film? What has it done for subsequent female superheroes?
Well, it opened the door. It's like, I honestly think if Wonder Woman had made $800 million, we wouldn't have gotten like a Captain Marvel movie, for instance.
Yeah.
I don't think we would have seen Ant-Man and the Wasp. It would have just been Ant-Man again, you know?
Finally, you're going to see it on Wednesday. It's released in cinemas tomorrow. You're going to see it on the big screen. I got a preview. Yeah. I can't say anything about it other than that they said, please watch this on the biggest screen you have, which was very good advice. You're going to see it in a very big screen.
My intention is to see it on the iSense. Odeon screen at the Point Village. That is my intention.
And to go do that on Wednesday. Well, enjoy, and I will be interested to hear what you have to say subsequent to seeing it. I have seen it today, and we will be talking about it on Thursday night's programme, Wonder Woman in 1984. But Carol Austin setting us up for that by giving us the potted history of Wonder Woman up to now, and it'll be in cinemas from Wednesday. That is our lot for this evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio.